Cliff Goldstein here. I want to talk about science, and I want to talk about the scientific revolution, and I want to talk about the hope that many really believe science would bring to humanity. Then I want to ask the question, basically, how well has science fulfilled the promises that many believed it offered, and what are the implications of the answer? Around the turn of the century, Wernher von Siemens, who created the famous Siemens Company, I think you've all seen those green and white trucks, he spoke to a group of people in Berlin, and he talked about the promise of science and technology. And I want you to read, I want to read this quote to you. Just listen to this. "Therefore, gentlemen, we will not be shaken in our belief that research and inventive activity leads mankind to higher levels of culture, ennobling it and making it more accessible to ideal aspirations, that the impending scientific age will diminish its hardships and its sickness, enhance its enjoyment of life, and make it better, happier, and more content with its fate." Okay, now, I want to ask you the question about that. Siemens wrote that, and at a time when he had a lot, in a sense, a lot to be optimistic about. I mean, after all, look at where science, and again, he wrote this right before the turn of the 20th century. See, look up until that time where science and the scientific revolution had taken humanity. From the earliest days of the scientific revolution, humans were replacing superstitions with hypotheses, traditions with mathematics, and dogma with experiment. From that time, science offered people, they believed, the hope of utopia. They offered the hope of an era in which humans, you know, with humans always at the mercy of nature, would finally uncover the secrets of nature, harness its power, and tame it. There was a German philosopher or a historian named Ernest Cashier. And let me read you in this really actually a fascinating little book called The Philosophy of the Enlightenment. He expressed here essentially the hope of science. And he goes, "The whole 18th century is permeated by this conviction, namely that in the history of humanity, the time had now arrived to deprive nature of its carefully guarded secret, to leave it no longer in the dark to be marveled at as an incomprehensible mystery, but to bring it under the bright light of reason and analyze it with all its fundamental forces." Now, the idea was simple. For long centuries, humans had been enslaved by superstition, enslaved by dogma, enslaved by ignorance. And the idea was that once we broke ourselves free of these intellectual absurdities, infinite possibilities of progress and advancement would be before us. We simply had to break away through the shackles of the long history of traditions and so forth, which was basically, in their thinking, the Catholic Church and the writings of Aristotle. And we break through that, and through new knowledge, through new ways of acquiring knowledge, through new concepts of what it meant to even know something, humans would become masters of their fate instead of their pawns. See, here's the thing, too. We live in an age where science is the authority. Science has become the authority. It's not easy for us to realize that science was really a revolution. It was a revolution against the authorities of the past. Francis Bacon, who lived in the 1600s, said that we had been for too many centuries dominated by five or six dead Greek pagans. And he and others were determined to break free from the shackles they had long imposed upon us. Focusing on reason and an experiment and observation, we could learn to harness nature. It was all there in nature itself, in the flowers and the trees, just waiting for men using reason, experiment, and science to pull the veil back and expose the secrets of the universe. In this new philosophy, what we call science now, everything was soon reduced to matter in motion. It was to molecules and atoms acting in accordance to set laws that could be explained through formulas. Though many of the early thinkers had started from a presupposition of God, eventually, particularly under the influence of the French, that whole idea was thrown out, and there was no more God. It was all nature and nature alone. It was this woman, Susan Neiman. I love this quote. She said here, the process by which to defend God with reason would become the wish to displace God with reason was a long one. But that was the point. Everything instead, you didn't need deity. Everything could be explained within nature, from the atoms to the motions of the star. No explanation from without. Nothing, you know, supernatural. It was all there in nature. Reality at every level was naturalistic and could be understood, you know, with those terms alone. If we didn't understand something, well, it was because we didn't know the science behind it. We didn't know the chemistry behind it. We didn't know the physical laws behind it. Nothing was supernatural. Nothing was above. Nothing was outside of nature. Only in and through nature could we come to understand nature, understand ourselves, and use it to our advantage. And, you know, you think about it, too. Look at the advantages. Crop failures were no longer attributed to old widows, witches who sold herbs in the marketplace and cast spells, but to weather patterns that followed set laws, astrological charts. They were being replaced with the works of Halley and Newton and Heschel, the grandchildren of those who burned old women as witches were now laying telegraph wires across the Atlantic. I mean, it was going on and on and on. People were pasteurizing milk when just a generation or two earlier, they actually believed if you took old sweaty sweaters and stuck them in a jar, you would create rats would come out of it. And then there were those who seen penicillin, who lived to see penicillin, you know, could remember times when doctors used leeches to try to cure disease. People weren't talking about alchemy anymore. They were talking about the chemistry of Boyle and Alessandro Volta. And better yet, not only was this new science was producing things. It was technology. There was the thermometer. Guy in 1814 took the first photograph. Samuel Morse produced the first telegraph. Damier, however you pronounce it, the German name, he produced the first four-wheeled vehicle. 1903, the Wright brothers flew. Nothing, it seemed, could stop the progress that we were making. And many believe we could create a heaven on earth. I think it was Ralph Waldo Emerson who caught the mood when he said, "Let man stand erect, go alone, and possess the universe." Anyway, one of the most eloquent voices of this sentiment was a name he's not really that well known today. You read him once in a while. His name was the Marquis de Condorcet. He was a Condorcet, excuse my French. You know, he was a philosopher and a mathematician, and he expressed the great hope of the time. Let me, if I find us here in this monstrosity, let me read you a quote that Condorcet wrote. You know, and this was a guy living in the 1700s, "No bounds have been fixed to the improvement of the human faculties. The perfectibility of man is absolutely indefinite." See, these were two things that were crucial in the thought back then. It was the idea of progress through reason and the perfectibility of mankind. And he says, "No bounds have been fixed to the improvement of the human faculties. The perfectibility of man is absolutely indefinite. The progress of this perfection, henceforth above the control of every power in the world that would impede it, has no other limits than the duration of the globe upon which nature has placed us." See, the bottom line in his thinking, as ignorance decreased, knowledge would increase, slavery would vanish, and all men would be free, and tyranny would be gone. Science, he believed, would lead to greater and greater benefits. The emancipation of women, the doubling or the tripling of lifespans, the freedom of the worker, and even perhaps the end of warfare. Now, there's a real funny irony. That isn't funny, it's kind of sad about Condorcet. Because he wrote this paean to human progress while he was running from his life from the first government ever founded on reason, the first government ever founded on the principles of this scientific revolution and enlightenment. And that was the France of the French Revolution. See, whatever great hope this new government first inspired, and there was a lot of hope. It was Wordsworth's famous lines. "Bliss was it to be that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven." He was a big fan of the revolution at first. There was all this hope. Within a few years, this Republic of Reason This republic that was founded on these principles of reason and science had collapsed into this mindless and irrational violence in which anybody at any time could be drugged through the streets, taken out, put on a guillotine, and their head chopped off before cheering crowds who just a few days before with their friends. At the height of this phase of the revolution called the terror, I think about 1,300 people were murdered, you know, in a single month in Paris, usually on the guillotine. I remember reading where they said it got so bad. There were so many people being their heads chopped off. There was so much blood that the local neighborhood was complaining. They're saying the blood is ruining the price of their houses. The housing market was going down because the neighborhood stench was so strong from the blood. All this from a republic founded on reason. And then there's the whole thing in the Vendée region of France where they just murdered people like mad over there. All this during the revolution. So the question I have is, how could such mindless and senseless slaughter happen in a republic founded on reason, on the same scientific principles supposedly that Galileo used to discover the moons of Jupiter, or that Newton used to uncover the laws of motion, gravity? Though the violence should have sounded a warning, this violence should have sounded a warning that moral progress didn't necessarily follow scientific ones, it didn't. And I think Condorcet's fate epitomized the delusion. See, it's kind of interesting. Not long after he penned these great words, talking about the virtues of this republic of reason and the virtues of humanity and all the hope of humanity, Condorcet, who had been fleeing for his life, he had hid 3 days in a rock quarry. He wandered into some restaurant somewhere, starving, and the woman at the tavern looked at him a little suspiciously, and she asked him, how many eggs are in your omelet? How many eggs in an omelet? And this guy, he didn't know, he never cooked anything. He was sort of elite. And he said, 12. And then she looked at him, what is your trade? And he just said, I'm a carpenter. And she looked at his hands and she said, well, those aren't carpenter's hands. Well, the bottom line is they suspected him as an enemy of the revolution. They took this guy who'd just been writing all these wonderful things about the perfectibility of mankind. They locked him up. They were getting ready to chop his head off because he was against, you know, the killing of the king. And before he did it, he took something and he died. They think he killed himself. But I think there's something so revealing, so prophetic, and so painfully ironic that this man, having just sung all these paeans, this praises to the perfectibility of mankind, kills himself with a vial of poison rather than have his head chopped off by a government founded on the very principles that were to lead to this absolute perfectibility of humanity. Now, I realize that, you know, it's funny, I was just in France a little while ago, and I was actually there for the French Revolution, which they celebrate, and there are different phases of the French Revolution and different understandings of it. But the point is, so you can look at it differently, but the point is, despite the horrific violence of the terror, as they call it, and some, you know, sort of just said that's just an aberration, the optimism can, you know, that was created by the scientific revolution continued and continued and continued even in to the wee hours of the 20th century. Now, though there were a few folks who warned against this, people like Nietzsche and Schopenhauer and so on, most people were very optimistic at the turn of the 20th century. Science was going to solve all the problems. In fact, there was an editorial in the New York Times, December 31st, 1899. And this is what it says. It says, tomorrow... So December 1st, 1899, they're right on the cusp of the new century. Tomorrow, we enter upon the last year of a century that is marked by greater progress in all that pertains to the material well-being and enlightenment of mankind than in all the previous history of the human race. So there was optimism. Jean-Paul Sartre, French philosopher, he was a kid then, and he wrote, in his biography, he told a little bit about what it was like living at that time. He said, it was paradise. The earth seemed nearly conquered by the joint efforts of Western imperialism and technological promise. Okay, it was a little facetious there, but he talked about, too, about the earth. You know, he talked about it was the age of telephone and the automobile and the airplanes were born and on all this pessimism. I mean, all this optimism. Then there was another. Here was another very interesting article in Atlantic Monthly back in September 1997. And here was a guy writing about, it's called Notes on the 20th Century, and he was writing about the feeling back then. Neither the earth nor even the sun was in the center of the universe anymore. But as Queen Victoria's chaplain Charles Kingsley had written earlier, the railroad, Cunard liners, and electric telegraphs are signs that we are on some point at least in harmony with the universe, that there is a mighty spirit working among us, the ordering and creating God. Men and women more than ever before or since felt at home on earth and in control of their destiny. The natural demons of the past had been banished by reason and electricity, and the human demons of the new century were still hidden. So you see, there was this prevailing optimism. We're going to do it. Science is progressing. I mean, we can fly, and we've got penicillin, and we're doing on and on and on. And so nothing, it seemed, could stop humanity and stop this progress, all thanks to science. Nothing could stop it. Well, there was one little slight issue that kind of dampened the enthusiasm a little. I mean, it was called World War I. I mean, this was humanity's first chance to use the marvels of science on a massive scale. All the technological advances of the previous century, and they had many, many, all converged into the sole purpose of killing as many people as possible and with a success that would have made Genghis Khan drool in his beard. Between physics, between chemistry, between mechanics and fluid dynamics and aviation, metallurgy, humans created battles that killed thousands within hours. Science offered soldiers things that in the past they never could understand. Mustard gas, flamethrowers, tanks, machine guns, and this machine gun and that machine gun. There was even a big artillery piece called Big Bertha, named after Krupp's wife. It was a 43-ton howitzer that could fire 2,000-pound shell 9 miles. I don't know what she thought about having that named after her, but anyway, then you had those quaint little Snoopy biplanes that we all like. They didn't have that a few years ago. Of course, they're so quaint compared to the B-29 bomber that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and that's nothing compared to the B-2 Spirit bomber today. The stealth bomber, which flies at supersonic speeds, its exact speed is classified, drops weapons from 50,000 feet. What is the point? The point, World War I, with millions dead and millions of more wounded, shattered this illusion that went on for over a century now about human progress and advancement. And whatever few diehards might have been left after World War I, there was World War II, where technology brought more death and destruction than even World War I. That cured them. And then you go on and on and on, and then who needs science fiction to think that World War I, World War II, think of what World War III is going to bring. I like this quote here from, what did I do with it? All right. Niebuhr. Reinhold Niebuhr. He talked about, listen to this. This is the whole point here. Niebuhr. The history of mankind, it's no more ironic experience than the contrast between the sanguine hopes of recent centuries and the bitter experiences of contemporary man. Every technological advance which previous generations had regarded as a harbinger or guarantor of the redemption of mankind from its various difficulties has proved to be the cause, or at least the occasion, for a new dimension of ancient perplexities. What a difference 100 years makes. I mean, despite scientists and scientific and technological advances that would have stunned the early 20th century, remember, that was when the Wright brothers just flew. We enter the 21st century with little or no, at least I'm not particularly optimistic about the redemption that science and technology is going to bring. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm scared to death of it, and rightly so. Despite all the conveniences, every advance in science is parsed and studied and exploited, how could it be used to bring death and destruction against enemies, real and imagined? No matter who we are, no matter where we live, we are in someone's eyes, one of those enemies whom it's their sacred duty to kill. See, we have learned to control nature, but we have not learned to control ourselves. And this is proven by the wars and the killings of the last century in which so many people are dead. You got to round it off to the nearest 10,000. That's how they do it. They round it off. That's why I think so few people today are deluded by the science and savior motif, which, you know, seems about as antiquated, as naive as the idea of, remember, a century ago, communism is the savior motif. Any hope that technology could redeem us, cure our ills, and save humanity vanished. I mean, if not in the shelling of Verdun, then maybe in the gas clouds of Auschwitz, or then maybe in what happened to Chernobyl. Hey, if you want to see something, go to Slate, SLATE.com. Go to Slate.com and look up the photographer, you know, Magnum photographer Paul Fusco, F-U-S-C-O, and look at the photos he took of the children who were born after Chernobyl. After Chernobyl, if you want to see where science is leading, if you want to see where technology is going, you get on that website, you look at Paul Fusco's photos of the children from Chernobyl, and you'll get an idea. Not long after the first atomic test, Oppenheimer, Robert J. Oppenheimer, one of the founders of the atomic bomb, he watched this bomb go off, and I think he, even though he created it, I think the poor man freaked when he saw what he had done. And he talked about people. Well, let me read you the quote. After the bomb went off, and it was a success. Science did it. They split the atom. They made a bomb. And here's what he wrote, Oppenheimer. We knew the world would not be the same. A few people laughed. A few people cried. Most people were silent. So I remember the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty and impress him to take on his multi-armored form and says, now I have become death, the destroyer of worlds. That's Oppenheimer. The only problem was science hasn't advanced enough to get us onto other worlds, which means, at least for now, the only world we can destroy is our own. And we can, much easier than before, folks. I mean, for centuries, I mean, when some deranged religious fanatic who believed he had 70 virgins waiting for him, you know, when he died, went on a jihad, he was generally a threat to, you know, his neighbors, you know. But, you know, folks, we're a global village now. And though that idea of a global village is supposed to evoke the warm fuzzies about the family of man and brotherhood and spaceship Earth and all that, the phrase merely means now that we could trade death just as fast as good as services. That means anyone anywhere from Butte, Montana to the Montparnasse is in danger from these people. And despite our clever attempts at mass murder, it's really only in the last 60 years have we achieved the ability to kill everyone on the planet. Quite a technological feat, considering that for thousands of years, people had to kill each other with arrows and axes. In short, in the 21st century, no matter who you are, no matter where you live, how innocuous your life, science, folks, science and technology, which was supposed to be our savior, the saving gods, have made it so much easier for strangers uttering unintelligible oaths and coming from lands that most of us couldn't find on a map, has made it easier for them to destroy you, to kill you, and destroy everything you've ever dreamed about or is important to you. Are much technological. It was Einstein. Einstein saw this. Einstein saw this. Here's Einstein. Okay, here's 1917. Here's Einstein in 1917 now. And look what he wrote. Einstein. Our much praised technological progress and civilization generally could be compared to an axe in the hand of a pathological criminal. An axe? How about a 20-ton, you know, a 20-megaton thermonuclear device instead? A pathological criminal? We should only be so lucky. How about a jihadist fanatic? Okay? So what of it then? You know, it was Wittgenstein, who I've talked about before. He once said that when all possible scientific questions have been answered, the most important questions of life have never even begun to be addressed. See, science in the end is simply mankind working within nature, studying nature, manipulating nature. And all that's fine. But in the end, nature being nature, it doesn't last forever. Sooner or later, whatever we do is going to fizzle out and it's going to decay and it's going to vanish. I mean, the second law of thermodynamics teaches that. And simply, science has made it easier. It's easier for that to happen. You know, It was a German, Heidegger, once said something. He said, only a God can save us. And his point was that unless there's something beyond what we see here, unless there's something beyond the world as it now is constituted, unless there's something beyond what we've got now, we have no coast, we have no hope, because in the end it's all going to swallow us up and everything is going to be gone. So in the beginning, I asked this question. I asked this question about the hope of the scientific revolution. Science was supposed to save us. It was supposed to save us. But you know, now I think it's more likely to kill us. Nature in the end is going to get us. And I think science in the end has made it easier for nature to do that. I guess what I'm saying is that if there is no God, if there is no supernatural, if there is nothing above us, nothing beyond nature, because again, all science is manipulating the nature, then we've got no hope whatsoever. And science, the God that was supposed to save us, is really the traitor, because more than anything, science could lead to our demise. So in the end, if we don't have something greater than us, beyond us, if there isn't a God, all we've got is ourselves and science to do us in.